You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And it was expected that as a sign of solidarity to the Soviet masters, that Mogilyuta and Carmen would be expected to lose the game. And her exact quote was, to demonstrate to the Romanian public the unquestionable superiority of Soviet man.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. In this episode, we hear from Craig McCracken, who spoke to us in episode 3. This time, he tells us about the strange world of football in Cold War Romania, and even if you are not interested in football, it's a fascinating chat about Cold War Romania. Craig runs the website beyondthelastman.com, described as 20th century football writing and nostalgia in a skilled and cultured groove. He really knows his football history. Are you liking the podcast and want to help? Well, for the price of a couple of coffees a month, you can help cover the show's increasing costs and keep us on the air. Plus, you get that sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster too. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. So, back to today's episode. We talk of the early Cold War years where pre-war clubs were dissolved in favour of the big two, through to the societal breakdown of the 1980s with defections, corruption, zombie clubs, and an unlikely European Cup success. I'm delighted to welcome back Craig McCracken to our Cold War conversation.
At the end of the war, the country was still a constitutional monarchy. But I think 1946, the communists won the elections, or they fixed the elections to win them with the help of the Soviets. A year later, by 1947, King Michel, who was the son of King Carol, who had abdicated during the war, he was forced to abdicate, and he left the country. And by 1948, essentially, the country was fully under communist control, and they started to break down all of the pre-war institutions and following the typical communist playbook of the mass nationalizations and systemization of agriculture and the likes, yes.
Right. So did that apply the same to sport as well? So did they dismantle those the pre-war clubs?
Well, absolutely. I mean, again, followed the model that was typical across all of Eastern Europe. Really, there was this overwhelming desire to rinse away the past, rinse away the history, and with Romanian clubs, that they were all kind of private concerns. There was supported by business. They were essentially professional capitalist as well. So there was a desire to wipe them from history. So we saw a loss of pre-war clubs, and the way it was done was sort of typical communist trick, really. A new law came in that dictated that all sports organisations had to join a trade union or a government institution, so that there could be no such thing as a private sporting club. So, a famous club called Juventus Bucharest, and they were moved to Ploiești, and they became Petrolul, a club of the oil workers. And Venus, who we talked about, of course, they had a fairly inauspicious ending to their life. They were forced to be able to retain a license and be able to play. They were forced to merge with a club a Bucharest club called UCB. And UCB were a minor club, and they were the club of the sewer workers of Bucharest. But they were a government institution. So Venus were forced to merge with those in 1948, I think that was. But then I don't think the club's heart was in it, and the club just folded totally in 1949.
Right.
But there was, I mean, I think the most telling story about that very awkward, difficult transformation in the immediate post-war era from what was a quasi-capitalist democracy to authoritarian communist state was the story of Carmen Bucharest. Now, Carmen Bucharest was a fairly new club. It was formed just in 1937 on the outskirts of Bucharest, and it was a sporting extension of the Motionita, probably excuse my pronunciation there, actually, a footwear company. And this was a company that was the biggest, the leading producer of shoes and boots in interwar Romania. So it was a sizable concern that exported abroad as well. So there, the patron of this company was a man called Dumitru Motionita, and he saw football as a good way of promoting his business, in very much the sort of type of business model that we see to this day. So there was no organized football during the war, of course, but there was friendlies were played. He put his son in charge, and his son was a lawyer, a kind of charismatic lawyer called Ionel, bon viveur and a football fan, and he started to assemble a crack team of some of the best players in Romania of the during the war era. So then we reached the end of the war, of course, and the communists took over, and the Motionitas were avowedly anti-communists, and the first clash that they had with the new authorities was with Anna Porker. Anna Porker was, I suppose, quite a notable Romanian historical figure, because she was the first female foreign minister of any country in the world ever. And she was very high up in the Communist Party in the post-war years. Anyway, the Soviet Dinamo Tbilisi side were touring, and it was a victory tour at the end of the war. And they were going to come to play Carmen in Bucharest. So Anna Porker met up with Motionita and basically explained to him that that this game would take place, and it was expected that, as a sign of solidarity to the Soviet masters, that Motionita and Carmen would be expected to lose the game. And her exact quote was, "to demonstrate to the Romanian public the unquestionable superiority of Soviet man." That was her precise quote. So Motionita wasn't happy with this at all. I mean, he was happy to play the game. He was happy to pay the travel expenses of the visitors, but he refused point blank to acquiesce with the request to go out and deliberately lose. So the game didn't happen. Tbilisi preferred not to play the game rather than come along and play and potentially lose. So this meant that Motionita had his card marked by the new government, of course. And they would have probably liked to have abolished Carmen at that point, but it was kind of difficult because Carmen had just won promotion with their star team in their first full season to League One, and with all the internationals playing and with all the star names, it would have been very difficult politically to disband them. So Carmen ended up having one season at the top, and they finished runners-up in the division. And finally, the government found the pretext it needed to disband them. And it was a derby game. They were playing another Bucharest team called Ciocano, which I believe translates as Hammer Bucharest. And they were winning, Carmen were winning the game 6-0. And they had a player called Basil Marian, who was a star, a maverick forward of the day. And he scored a goal where he dribbled past a number of players and the keeper, and he stopped in the line, sat in the ball, and shielded his eyes as if seeking out an opponent to come and stop him scoring. So the newspapers jumped on this. This was seen as showboating, and it was humiliation of the opponents. The club was labelled a circus and a nest of enemies of the sport. So it was a fabricated outrage behind the scenes. The mainland federation met in the close season, exacted revenge on Carmen, and refused them the place in the league, and the club was immediately dissolved. So we'll talk about what happened to the players in the club in the seconds when we come on to the new clubs that were formed. But a number of players defected, a number of players left, and most of the players left joined other clubs as well. The Mochinitas, the father and son, had numerous opportunities to leave the country because their safety was not guaranteed by this point, but they passed up those opportunities. Shortly afterwards, all their assets were seized and nationalised, and the pair of them were handed lengthy jail sentences, which they were forced to serve in really appalling conditions. Dumitru, the father, caught pneumonia, and he died in jail in 1953. I think he was about in his mid-60s. The son, Yonel, he served 7 years in jail, and he was eventually released. But he refused to demand that he spied for the authorities in unmasking bourgeois influences within his former social circle. So he stayed in, he was a prisoner, essentially, in Bucharest for the next 15 years, and his every move was tracked by the Securitate until he was finally allowed to emigrate to Canada in 1970. And I suppose there was a happy ending. He did return to Romania following the 1989 revolution.
Right, right. And you mentioned that new clubs were formed. So are they some of the names that we'd be familiar with nowadays?
Well, absolutely. The two new clubs who emerged in the post-war years, the two majors, and they're still the major clubs to this day, are Dinamo Bucharest, who were the team of the police and the secret police, the Ministry of the Interior, and Steaua Bucharest. Now, I'm just going to emphasise the pronunciation because I think people I think through various television commentators over the years have pronounced them as Steaua, which is how it reads to us in English, S-T-E-A-U-A. And I think that's stuck. But the actual pronunciation in Romanian is Steaua Bucharest, because apparently Steaua, if you say Steaua in Romanian, it is a slang word for male genitalia. So you probably don't want to.
Brilliant.
Do that.
Well, I'm glad you pronounced those names before I did, because I would have made that elementary mistake. So thank you for that.
That's okay. You're very welcome. And Steaua, they became the army club, essentially. And this was very much the same model that we saw across Eastern Europe with the police and the army club being the major clubs of influence as well. So they and Steaua, Dinamo Bucharest were a merged team. There are a couple of significant pre-war clubs, Unirea Chicala and Ciocana, who I mentioned a moment ago. Bucharest, they merged and they became Dinamo. Steaua were a totally new club, and they inherited Carmen Bucharest's place in the top division when Carmen were liquidated, and many of their players as well. So they got very much a running start in their career.
Right.
But of course, the benefits with any of the army teams was that they could call up talented players to serve their national service there. And it was a charter for players because if they went to serve their national service playing for Steaua, then they couldn't actually ever do anything military-wise. Yeah. They would just basically play sport, yeah, of course. And you always had the prospect of foreign travel when you were playing for one of the major clubs as well. So it was an appealing prospect. And the club was actually, we call them Steaua, they became Steaua in 1959, I think, actually. They started out as ASA, which was the Army of Bucharest, and then became CCA Bucharest. We'll probably touch upon as well that kind of communist habit of wanting to rename their clubs almost every single season into something totally different, yeah, as well. But yeah, they became Steaua as we know them today, and as they become known today. Though even that's complex, and we'll touch upon that later. From the late 1950s, and those two would create something of a duopoly. It became an absolute duopoly by the 1980s, but in the early years, they were the most significant clubs. But there were other forces in the Romanian game in the post-war years.
Right, right. And you mentioned travel. So were these sides playing in European competitions?
Well, European competition started roughly the mid-1950s, and so the Romanian clubs were active from a fairly early stage. But there was a kind of insularity that dominated the Romanian mentality when it came to football, and for certainly the 50s and most of the 1960s. There was a real suspicion because of the kind of capitalist professionalism of the game had undergone in the pre-war years as well. So in 1958, there was an example where severe punishments were handed down for when it was proven that certain footballers had been paid, and 20 sports stars were banned for life. So, and of course, Romanian, their focus, sporting focus, was, again, like a lot of the Eastern Bloc, on Olympic sports. And Romania had, from those early years, had a very, very good tradition in sports like gymnastics and weightlifting. And that became very much the priority, I think, and football was pushed to one side in many respects. Then it changed a little bit. I mean, CCA, Steaua, as it became known, they toured in England in 1955, and that was the first time a Romanian club had truly toured abroad. And I think it was accepted that if football was to develop, then they did need external influences, and that it was seen as a positive thing. But the 50s and 60s weren't especially auspicious decades for the game in Romania at all.
Okay. I mean, it's almost like there are similarities there with East Germany, with the emphasis on Olympic sport, which is probably more able to be influenced, I guess, than a bigger team sport like football.
Well, absolutely. You can dope footballers as much as you like, and it's not going to make them pass the ball better or head the ball better. And the athletic and cardiovascular enhancements can only take you so far in football. It helps, of course, and doping was rife in football. And to be honest, in Western Europe as well during these years, because there's big question marks against the West German team who won the 1954 World Cup against Hungary, and the came to light about doping and how the players were given amphetamines and suffered severely from jaundice as well. So it wasn't exclusively an Eastern European thing, but certainly with the Olympic sports and individual sports, they were much easier to manipulate for political gain than football ever was.
Yeah. So we've sort of covered the 40s and the 50s. So in the 60s, was there more participation in international football then, or was that not until really under Ceausescu and the 1970s?
Well, Ceausescu took over as General Secretary of the Communist Party 1965. Thank you. Maybe it was about 1967 before he finally took control of all of the levers of power and started developing his infamous cult of personality, of course. And he himself wasn't a football man at all, but almost by accident he happened to stumble into a time when Romanian football was on the rise, and there was a lot of talented and natural talent. And what you started to see was changes happening a little bit under Ceausescu in the kind of late 60s, and 1970 was a kind of key year for the game. But just come back to Ceausescu.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's libsynads.com.
It's easy to forget now, but of course, in his early years, he was seen as almost like a force for good by the West, as a moderating force, because obviously he was quite unique in the Eastern Bloc, because he condemned the the invasion of Prague, the Prague Spring in the 1968 spring, when obviously Soviet and tanks rolled in to put down an uprising there. And he condemned that as well. And of course, the West, Americans and Britain saw him as somebody that they could work with. And he was very close to the French as well. Actually, the French loved him for some curious reason, and we even managed to, the number of times they entertained him and his very curious wife Elena, that we will, I'm sure, talk about. But anyway, in his early years, there was some liberalisation from what had gone on before. That didn't last very long, but in a footballing form, he was happy to let open up the borders for players to move abroad when they reach the age of 32 and play out the last couple of years of their career in their friendly countries. So France was a very friendly country. So a number of players went to France, then went to Turkey, Belgium. And this was, again, we talked about this in the East German episode. Well, most countries allowed this. This was their kind of one payoff to players. If you keep your head down, kept quiet, did your duty, served your country, played with distinction, then we'll let you have a couple of years at the end of your career where you make some money abroad, but with very strict age limits put on. So mm-hmm. from 1968 to 73, that happened with Romanians. You started to see Romanians go abroad. But the problem was that as soon as most of them went abroad, they kind of quite preferred it there. And tried to find whatever reasons that they could not to come back as well. So that liberalisation shut down fairly quickly. But 1970 was a significant year because Romania qualified for the World Cup, and it was the first World Cup that they had participated in since 1938. And they had a very talented team with players like Mircea Lucescu, who won and still is one of the greatest coaches that the team's produced, but he was a fine player as well. And Romania were joining England's group in Mexico. It's a very difficult group alongside Brazil and Czechoslovakia, and they didn't progress, but they played with distinction, and they very, very impressive team. They impressed everybody with their professionalism and the quality of their football. So, and that same year as well, I mean, we talk about European competition, and Romanian clubs hadn't really made many inroads, but UT Arad, the textile team from the city of Arad, they drew Feyenoord, who were the Dutch champions and the European champions in 1970 in the first round of the European Cup, and eliminated them. So it was the first time we'd ever seen a Romanian club take a big scalp like that in European competition. So, again, that was in tandem with the progress made by the national team, that was seen as a big step forward for the Romanian game.
What would you say that was down to? They had good coaches, good players?
Yeah, I mean, there was a generation of good players came through, and the coaching's early. And the most famous coach, I mean, the coach of the 1970 team was a chap called Angelo Niculescu, and he's a coach who's still revered by modern tacticians today, and he had his particular theories of temporization, when to speed up the game, when to slow down the game. So he was a thinker, and he was somebody who studied football abroad with us as much as he could with the limitations imposed upon him. And another, probably Romania's most famous manager of the year was a fellow called Stefan Kovacs. And Kovacs had been a decent player, and he had been a successful manager, and he'd won titles as a manager with Steaua Bucharest. But what was really, really unusual, as a surprise to everybody, was when Ajax won the European Cup for the first time in 1971, they did that under Rinus Michels, the famous Dutch coach. He was with the team with Cruyff and Neeskens, a very famous team. Anyway, he left to take over Barcelona, and Ajax recruited this unknown Romanian, Stefan Kovacs, and everybody was amazed that they would do this, because he was very little known outside his own country. He was given special dispensation to leave, of course, and he was given a 2-year visa to go and work abroad, and he coached and he won a further two European Cups with Ajax, and he was a great success. And so he really advanced the kind of notion of remaining coaching. And obviously when his time at Ajax was over, he had a short spell in charge of the French national team, still the only foreigner ever to coach the French national side. And then he came back and he was very influential in, you know, continuing behind the scenes. So despite the political shenanigans and despite the idiocy of Ceausescu, there was smart people. And there was good footballers, there were smart coaches. I wouldn't say there was good administrators, but and all of this happened despite Ceausescu and despite the political system.
And was Romania relatively unique in allowing sort of their coaches and certainly their sports people to work abroad? I mean, I think of Ilie Năstase, for example, from the tennis world, but I can't think of, and then I'm not that necessarily aware of Eastern European football during the Cold War, but whether any other Eastern Bloc coaches worked in the West.
Well, very much so. I mean, Romania, I would say probably the only Romania, East Germany, and Albania were probably the three nations of the three Eastern Bloc nations who were the most resistant to their people moving abroad in any form or other. I mean, Albania just didn't happen at all. East Germany and Romania, that happened, significantly started to happen as the economic climate of Romania worsened. Of course, it started to happen through defections. But there was this kind of conflict of understanding that it was useful for coaches to work abroad and learn about different systems and different playing styles. But Kovacs, for example, was seen to be politically reliable. He had a family back home. He was seen as somebody who was not going to rock the boat. He wasn't going to make a fuss. He wasn't going to embarrass the regime. So a lot of it was down to vetting. But, I mean, other countries, you know, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Poles, their coaches tended to go abroad much more readily than tended to happen in Romania, really. And particularly so as what you tended to find was liberalisation was forced upon these nations as time advanced. But Ceausescu was such a paranoid individual that the opposite, actually, probably by the time of his downfall in the late 1980s, Romania was a considerably less liberal nation than it had been when he'd taken over in the 1960s. So it was a kind of reverse polarity there going on with him.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned there was an age limit for players to play abroad. Was that ever changed if, you know, there was an opportunity for, I don't know, a hard currency or something like that in return for a player playing abroad?
Well, there was a famous incident in the early 70s, just sort of moving forward a couple of years in time. And the first proper Romanian modern-day footballing superstar is a player who's probably not that well known to your listeners. His name was Nicolae Dobrin. And he's not famous because he never played for any of the major Western clubs, and you know he didn't have the kind of career that good players have nowadays. He played the vast majority of his career in Peteste with the local club Argeș, and they were a force in the game in the 70s for a while, primarily down to him. He was a kind of creative attacking midfielder. Very skillful, beautiful to watch. If you find some footage, there's some footage of him on YouTube, not very much, but you can see what a wonderful player he was. Anyways, Argeș Peteste were champions of Romania, and they drew Real Madrid in the European Cup, and this was 1971-72 season. And Real Madrid prevailed, but very narrowly, and Argeș gave them a very, very difficult two games over two legs. And Dobrin was fantastic. And Santiago Bernabéu, who was the obviously the Real Madrid's president, he was very, very taken with Dobrin. And he contacted the regime, and he wanted to buy him. He wanted to pay $2 million to buy him. And hard currency was always a big thing for Chesview because, as we talked about a little bit with East Germany, one of the ways in which he made he brought in hard currency to the country was selling exit visas to Romania, to Israel and Germany. Obviously, there's a big German enclave within Romania, German-speaking enclave, and so the German government would buy out the German-speaking people and rehouse them in West Germany. And the same happens with Israel as well. Most of the Romanian, the Jewish community around Romania were bought out as such by Israel, and they were allowed to move to leave the country and move to Israel. So people trading was very much one of his preferred methods of bringing in hard currency. So the opportunity to sell a footballer for a sizable amount of money, and in fact, Ceausescu himself conducted the negotiations with Santiago Bernabeu over the potential transfer of this player. And it didn't happen in the end. He decided that it would, if he let one player go, then it would be very, very hard to kind of keep the finger in the dike, so to speak, and stop other ones leaving at the time. So Dobran wasn't permitted to leave, and he had to play out the rest of his time in Romania with Argeș Putești. And he wasn't especially resentful, but yeah, I mean, it's for the first time Romania had footballers who were craved and sought after by big Western clubs, and Ceausescu was starting to discover the temptations that were going to be there for those players, and starting to find how difficult it was to keep his insular system intact against the pressures from the Western European game.
Yeah. Did they have a problem with players on international tour not returning?
Goodness me. This became much more of a problem, yeah. I mean, by the time we sort of, if we move on a few years time-wise, and we start to see the breakdown of Romanian society, and I think a lot of this came down to the ruinous economic policies of Ceausescu, and ruinous policies, the social policies. Of course, there was the 1966 policy that him and Elena decided that Romania, to be able to sustain its industrial base, needed a bigger population. So any sort of abortion was banned, and all sorts of efforts were put in place to promote families having as many children as possible. And you know, if you didn't have children or you only had one child, you were punitively taxed. So that was something that had a catastrophic effect in the social fabric of the country. The economic side of things was ruinous as well. Ceausescu borrowed heavily. He was given quite a lot of financial grants and assistance from the West in his early days because they thought he was somebody that they could work with. So he ran up a huge foreign debt that he tried to invest in Romanian in oil industry to expand that, and that was disastrous when you had the collapse in oil prices in the mid-1970s. And then, of course, he started hanging around with China and North Korea, and he started to adopt some of the ideas of the juice, the kind of independence of North Korea. And from 1977, I think it was, onwards, he determined that Romania would repay all of its foreign debt, which saw, obviously, the country enter this prolonged period of austerity that drove down living standards to calamitously low levels. So the country was starting to collapse, and his paranoia was just it's almost kind of comical for us if we look at it now, but it must have been quite horrible if you had to live through it. I mean, there was these laws, for example, if a newspaper mentioned him, no one else but his wife could be named in the same paragraph. And if both him and Elena were mentioned in the paragraph, they had to both be on the same line of that paragraph. And then furthermore, every page of a paper had to mention him a minimum of 40 times, and his name had to be in the specialised fonts. And it's crazy. I'm just checking back some of the stories as well. And in he once received a written death threat, and he instructed the Securitas, his infamous secret police, to procure handwriting samples of every single citizen in the country to try to find out who had sent him his death threats, you know. So crazy. And you know, every telephone manufactured in Romania came standard with a bug embedded within it for surveillance purposes as well. So,
there's definitely a few episodes worth for me to cover Elena and Nicolae Ceaușescu, without a doubt.
My favourite and contextual to football, I suppose, here we talk about my favourite Elena one. I don't think she really had much interest in football, but for some reason she was put in charge of determining which football matches would be televised every week. Goodness knows why, and goodness knows what a rationale for that was, but yes, anyway. The economic collapse was precipitous, and by the time you start to get to the 1980s, then we started to see defections, and defections was a big thing we spoke about in these German episodes as well, because I think it was a little bit different with East Germany, because with East German players, they were very much exposed to what life in the West was like, West Germany, and that counterpoint was just too tempting for many of them. And of course, most of the players who did defect ended up in West Germany. With Romania, it was different, because it was absolute poverty, really. Romania was declining into becoming almost like a third world nation within a first world continent. And the players, of course, had the responsibilities of professionals, but the pay of amateurs. So, I mean, yeah, we started to see quite a lot of notable defectors. The saddest one, the most tragic one, was a player called Dan Cole. And Dan Cole was a defender. He played for Rapid Bucharest. And he was a member of the 1970 World Cup team. He came from a well-thought-of family. I think his father had been part of the war effort, and he'd fought for the communists. So he had a strong heritage, and he was trusted in that respect. But 1971, anyway, he managed to escape from a game, and made his way to Belgium, and he was given a contract with Antwerp. And he was the first notable defecting player, certainly the first international player, I believe, who defected. So the authorities were taken very much by surprise. He played there in Belgium for a couple of years, and then he agreed to return to Romania only if his safety was guaranteed, which it was. So he came back, he was 31, and he wanted to go back to his former club and pick up his career at Rapid Bucharest. But, of course, he was never going to be allowed to do that. He had to be punished directly and indirectly. So he ended up being put, he went to Galati in the second division, and he played with them, and then he retired, and then he coached them, and he won promotion for them. But there was a glass ceiling on him. The authorities were never going to let him progress. So then, move on a few years in 1980, he requested and he was granted a short-term travel permit to Belgium under the pretext of visiting his old Antwerp colleagues. I'm surprised that was actually granted him, but it was anyway. And of course, this was just a ruse to escape again. And so he arrived in Belgium, made his way to West Germany, and he settled in Cologne as a political refugee. October 1981, this was, he was found hanged in his apartment, and in the likelihood that it was suicide was probably stripped away by the manner in which his body was found, because his hands and his ankles were manacled and cuffed to suggest that he couldn't possibly have committed suicide, and it just wasn't physically impossible. And Dan Cole's big mistake, unlike some of the other defectors, was that he was very vocal about Ceaușescu and about the regime that he left behind. And he used to speak regularly to Radio Free Europe. And just a few days before his death, he had conducted an interview with Radio Free Europe, where he had lambasted Ceausescu and criticised the human rights. And then, within a couple of days, he was found dead. And the murder, the nature of the murder, was very much in keeping with the modus operandi of the Securitas, who were operating with impunity around Europe at the time, imposing brutal retribution against any enemies of Ceausescu. And that was one of the most tragic examples of a player who went against Ceausescu and was too vocal about it and lost his life.
Right, right. And how was the army? Well, is it? I'm not going to be able to pronounce. What was it? Stewa.
Stewa, yeah. Think of it as in stair climbing, a set of stairs, and W-A at the end, Stewa.
Oh, okay. Stewa and Dynamo, how were they faring during this period?
Well, I mean, the 60s, and they won many trophies in the 60s and 70s, but there were other teams that had some success as well, and teams like UT Arad. I mentioned Argues Peteste with Nikolai Dobran, of course. In the late 70s, you saw an emergence of a really strong University Craiova side as well, who had some success. But I think when we hit the 1980s, this is when...
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Everything changed quite considerably. And the Romanian football at that point gave up any pretense of being a truly competitive environment, and it became a vicious duopoly between Dinamo and Steaua. You had, after kind of Craiova, you know, Dinamo took over in the early 80s, and they were a very, very powerful team under Mircea Lucescu, who I mentioned earlier, one of the great coaches. And the machinations that went on with the between the two clubs was not the sort of type of thing that you tended to see elsewhere. So whenever there was a derby going on, for example, between the two clubs, then because Dinamo Bucharest were the team of the Securitas, then that obviously gave them influence to all sorts of manner of underhand tricks to try to undermine their opponents as well. So, for example, like 1981, there was a player called Stefan Jovan, who was a talented defender, and Steaua were close to signing him. But Dinamo Bucharest wanted to acquire him. So they attempted to disrupt the deal, and their way of doing that, of course, was by blackmailing the player over a woman that he had made pregnant 2 years earlier, and was obviously a secret from his wife as well. So, and then ahead of a derby against Steaua, the police would disrupt the Steaua captain, who's a player called Cidarel Stoica, by having the police back in his hometown of Galati arrest his heavy drinking father and have him thrown in jail for the night as well, to obviously to distract him and take his focus off the game in hand. So every transfer, every deal to acquire players that became like this, there became war of attrition between the two clubs. But the turning point, I think, was Dinamo very much had the upper hands, and in fact, even down to the Ostera's offices were bugged by the Securitas, and they made a big play of letting Ostera know that they knew all the tactics in advance because they listened into them. But what changed the playing fields was, I think we've moved to about 1983 now, and the head of Ostera at the time, who was the head of the army ministry, he was a general called Constantine Oltianu, and he realised that this was all about influence, carrying influence, and he realised Ostera were losing this battle. So in the hope of trying to turn the tide, he wanted to get the Ceausescus involved, which was like inviting, putting piranhas into your fish tank, really. And the Ceausescus were never especially interested in football. But anyway, Valentin, who was one of Nicolae's sons, he took over. And Nicolae was a curious figure, unlike his other brother, one of his other brothers, Niku, who was a typical playboy, and he drove his car around drunk and running people over, and his father having to smooth over his indiscretions. Valentin was more of a humble figure. He was trained as a nuclear physicist. He drove a Dacia, and he was a kind of quiet man. He had no experience as a football official, but apparently his dedication and his common sense earned him respect. And in fact, some of the Steaua players later, after the Ceausescu regime fell, spoke quite fondly of him. So he came in as a general manager, but of course that then changed because being a Ceausescu meant that whatever he wanted to happen could happen, and the game in Romania declined into farce, really, because it became a fix. It became the duopoly that we spoke about. We had zombie clubs making up the other places at the behest of the powers that be. But curiously, despite all of the corruption that took over the standard of football and the successes that of Romanian football in the 1980s continued to blossom, which is an incredible dichotomy that I just couldn't begin to explain how that could possibly have happened. But it did.
Because if they're not playing against, well, properly competitively, yeah, it makes you wonder how they would perform well against other international sides. But I understand there was a European Cup success.
They started, Romanian clubs had made little impact in European club competition before the 1980s. But when that did start to change, University of Craiova, they reached a UEFA Cup semi-final in 1983. Dinamo Bucharest, they reached the European Cup semi-final in 84 and narrowly lost to Liverpool that year. And then Steaua, of course, who went better still, and they actually won the European Cup in 1986, which was incredible. I remember at the time, I was only 18 at the time, and they were the one of only two Eastern Bloc, Eastern European teams to win the European Cup. The second one would be Red Star Belgrade, just when Yugoslavia collapsed a few years later, 1991, but Steaua were the first to win. There'd only ever been one Eastern European team had even reached a European Cup final before, which was Partizan Belgrade back in 1966. And this was a team who, as soon as Valentin took over, basically assumed total command of Romanian football. And they had a 104-game unbeaten run domestically from the start of the 1986 season right the way through to the time the regime fell. And this was down to dodgy refereeing. It was down to referees playing on as long as it needed for Steaua to find a goal, offside goals given for them, perfectly good goals by opponents disallowed. So, not a competitive environment at all, you would think, when they basically just had to run out onto the pitch and they were guaranteed to win all of the league games. But they had a fine team and it managed to go all the way in Europe. And in the European Cup in 1986, they reached the final. they were very much second favourites. They were playing Barcelona, and Barcelona managed by Terry Venables at the time. And the game was played in Seville as well, so it was virtually a home game for Barcelona. And it was one of the worst European Cup finals I've ever seen. I think everybody would say that. It was nothing each. There was barely a shot on target the whole game. It went to penalty kicks, and Steyr was a famous keeper, Helmut Dukadam, saved four kicks, and Steyr won 2-0 in the penalty shootout, and they became Romania's first ever, only ever European trophy winners. So, yeah, it was absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You describing Romanian football in the 1980s makes East German football that we described in the previous episode seem quite a fair and level playing field.
Well, I mean, it was, I mean, we can talk a little bit about what I tend to be the zombie clubs, but one of them was this. Was a club called Victoria Bucharest. And this was a club that had been around in various different guises for decades. And they'd always been a B team for Dinamo primarily. But while this duopoly was going on, it was almost like Dinamo introduced this team. They were promoted back up into the top division for the first time in 1985. And then every year after that, they finished in third place. They would never beat Steaua. They never beat Dinamo. Steaua were always first. Dinamo were always second. Victoria Bucharest were always third. Each of those four seasons up until the end of the Ceausescu regime that Victoria were in the top division, they would reach the cup semi-final, and they would lose four times in successive seasons to Dinamo Bucharest. And every time they would lose by a two-goal margin. Sometimes it was 2-0, sometimes it was 4-2, but... So, yeah, everything was hierarchical. Everything was ordered. It was a farce. And for a team from such, still considered to be obviously a soccer outpost, to become champions of Europe and form this from this background was incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So... What happened with these sides with the fall of Ceausescu?
Well, I mean, I'll just mention, just when we're talking about this, the stagnant state of the domestic game. I'll just tell you a little bit about another of the clubs that didn't outlive the Ceausescu regime, because Victoria Bucharest didn't outlive them. They were shut down within months of Ceausescu being executed. Another club was a club called FC Olt Skonicesk. And Skonicesk, for your Ceausescu scholars out there, is a village, a tiny village, which happened to be the birthplace of Nicolae Ceausescu himself. And this was a team, this was a town, a village of 6,000 people. And it was also one of the towns, villages that was chosen for Ceausescu's policy of systemization. And this was the part of his rapid industrialization program in the 70s that involved basically raising down everything old and replacing it with more industrial friendly mid-rise apartment blocks, for example. So Ceausescu's part of the wanting to raise the amount of working population he had in the country as well. You know, he plans this to be one of the many times where the population would rise as well. So he ended up in this little village, and everybody's houses, everybody's farms were bulldozed, and they were put into apartment blocks. And in fact, the only old building that existed in Skonicesk was Ceausescu's birthplace, which was unsurprisingly allowed to stand. But anyway, they had a football team as well, and started in the early 70s, and it started to obviously progress towards the late 1970s, up towards the top of the Romanian game. And in slightly slightly kind of comical fashion as well. Skonicesk were chasing promotion to the top flight for what would have been the first time. And on the last day of the season, They had to play a club called Elettrodo Slatina, and they had to win by a goal margin equal to or more than another club called Flacara Moreni, who were another state club. Then erroneously informed that Flacara were winning 9-0, and that actually they were winning 3-0, Ceausescu's team upped the ante and ended up winning this game 18-0. Now, what happened, there was no phone line connecting the villages where Steaua and Flacara Moreni were playing. So men with hand radios were stationed at intervals between the ground, relaying garbled scores like Chinese whispers, which led to this slightly comical situation. And after the referee blew for full time and the teams found off the pitch, the chairman of Skornicesk, he actually went, got the players out of the shower, got the referee, took them all back onto the pitch and made them play on to score a few more goals just to make sure that they had enough goals to win by. So it was 18-0 was the score. It was 1-0 at half time and 17 goals in the second half. So that was very typical. And Skornicesk, they went up to, I think they finished, they were the first village ever to play in the top flight of Romanian football. And they finished, I think in 1982, they finished as high as fourth, again, because they were seen as an institution club. But the irony was that Ceausescu himself wasn't ever really that interested in football or his own club. And in fact, it was his brother-in-law who was the communist general secretary there who was the main influence in the rise in Skornicesk. And obviously, he had a lot of influence himself to bring to bear to take the club as high as they did. And I mean, the most ridiculous thing about the old Skornicesk story was this was a town that even after the systemization process, its population never really topped out more than about 10,000. But the general secretary, Barbulescu, he decided in the mid 1980s that this was a town or this was a village and a football club that needed an international class stadium. And they built a 30,000 capacity stadium, which was at the time the second biggest in Romania and certainly one of the most advanced in facility-wise. Then obviously within 4 years, Skornicesk were closed down because they were seen as a Ceausescu club. The team folded, a new club opened, a new club started and played in their position. Down in the fourth or fifth tier of the remaining game, and now that 30,000 stadium, they're lucky if they see crowds of about 60 or 70 at home games.
Wow. Have you ever been there to watch a game?
No, it's a way out in the middle of nowhere. In fact, some of the players who were assigned there to go and play for them, and they had some good players, of course, and they're very famous Romanian player called Victor Peturca, who's one of the Romanian greats. He started his career there and he spent four seasons. And it was literally a one-horse town. There was one cafe that all of the players used to sit and drink and bemoan that how they had ended up in this muddy hellhole, because apparently it was only one attempt at a road. And for whatever reason, that the whole town was just mud. Everywhere was mud and concrete. And they said they would sit in the cafe and they would watch, and they could sit for 2 or 3 hours and not see a single car go past. So it's we're in the middle of nowhere. And I think if you've travelled to Romania, you're not getting around anywhere, but public transport's hard enough.
Yeah.
Getting between the major centres. So
yeah.
I think if you're going to try and get to Skornicesk, you might struggle.
Yeah. So with the fall of Ceausescu, what happens then to these? Obviously, some of these clubs disappear, but what about the Dinamo and Steaua? I got it in the end.
Well, Victoria Bucharest went, and old Skornicesk, they went. It looked like Dinamo Bucharest were going to go as well because they were so strongly affiliated to the Securitate and the Ministry of the Interior, who had committed all sorts of heinous crimes against the population. In the early days after Ceausescu's execution, the club tried to preempt that, and they changed the name to Unirea Chicola, which is one of the clubs, the pre-war clubs that had been part of, that had been merged into another club to become Dinamo in the first place. But then what tended to happen, and this is very typical of Romanian life in general, was that after the huge upheaval of the first few months following the revolution, I think people started to realise that apart from getting rid of Ceausescu and his wife, it wasn't really a huge revolution at all, because the same people who had been in positions of power before or during the 1980s and during communist era tended to find themselves in positions of power in the years that followed as well. And that, whether that was whether that was in government or in fact in football as well. And the chairman I mentioned, Skonicesc, who was behind the fixing of that club, he was he also was the chair of the president of Victoria Bucharest, another discredited club. And he was also president of Flăcari Mureni, who were another discredited club. And yet he became the head of the Romanian Football Federation for over a decade in the 90s and into the early 2000s. So the upheaval kind of went away a little bit. And after people realized that it was quite similar, I think, in East Germany as well, that with Dynamo Berlin. And immediately the club changed its name because it wanted to put distance between itself and its roots. But then it kind of realized that it carried a certain brand value, and Dynamo Bucharest carried a significant brand value, having been, you know, a force in Europe. So it prevailed, and it continues to this day. Still, we're never really under any threats of change at the time. And they, despite the Valentin Ceausescu.
Yeah, because presumably because they were the army club, and the army was really the people who brought Ceausescu down.
Yeah, I think there was that association. They managed to separate out the Ceausescu affiliation and the influence that they'd had. Defer to the army sides of that process, definitely.
As you can hear, Craig really knows his stuff, and I highly recommend a visit to his website, Beyond the Last Man, for numerous Cold War football stories. We have a link to his site and various Romanian football videos in our show notes. This will also show as a link in some podcast apps. Don't forget, if you'd like to get that Cold War Conversations coaster and keep us on the air, head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate, or again, click on the link in your podcast app. If you can't wait for the next episode, head over to our Facebook discussion group, where our guests and listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.